On the Murder Squad, we discuss details of crimes that are often violent in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Billy Jensen.
I'm Paul Holes.
This is the Murder Squad. One, six, 18, 25, 38. These may sound like just numbers, but according to the Human Rights Campaign, since the beginning of 2021, there have been 38 violent deaths of transgender or gender nonconforming persons in the United States. It's on pace to be the most murders in United States history. Each of these numbers have a name. They have a family, and they have friends.
One victim was shot while walking down the road with her boyfriend. Another murdered in her apartment. One of the women was eating at a picnic table. And still another shot on the very same street she'd survived a vicious stabbing 2 years before. These women and so many more need our help. Our job, to find the killers of Devaria Alexander, Serenity Hollis, Iris Santos, Alexis Braxton, and Kiera LaPree Cartier.
This is the Murder Squad.
Hey, Billy, you're looking very contemplative.
I am.
What's up?
It looks like we have been nominated for the iHeart Radio Best Crime Podcast.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, that's awesome.
We are up against Crime Junkie, our friend Lacey Mosley, Scam Goddess, To Live and Die in L.A., and Dr. Death.
Wow.
So apparently, voting will begin, I believe, December 13th. So if you want to see pictures of me and Paul in tuxedos, if we go to the award show, please vote. But we'll give you guys an update on that. But that's pretty cool, though. I had no idea that was happening, but that's pretty cool.
Oh, that's awesome. And I think that just is. I would never in my wildest dreams have believed that I would be nominated for something like that. You know,
yeah, no,
we've done a great job.
Yeah. Now, everybody, thank you. Everybody, yeah. Exactly right. And definitely Polly and Steven, especially for doing this during the pandemic, too, which has been, you know, so different for us. So, you know, we have another update. We cover the disappearance of Dashina Kyle, season 3, episode 23. She was last seen on June 18th, 2021 in Knoxville, Tennessee. And she last spoke with her friends on the 23rd. After she was reported missing, police immediately believed that she was in danger. Her car and dog were still at her home with no sign of Dashina. At the time, it's believed that Dashina was being stalked by her ex-boyfriend, a guy named John Bassett. He had previously been charged with domestic violence in an incident involving Dashina. Unfortunately, on September 28th, her body was discovered. And according to the insider, the location was at an abandoned property owned by one of Bassett's family members on Sam Tillery Road. Her death has been ruled a homicide, but cause of death is pending the full autopsy report, and currently no charges have been filed in the case yet. So with this one, it, you know, this news is pretty recent. We're recording this a little bit ahead of time, so there might be some news that came out with this, but obviously our thoughts go out to the family, and we're going to be watching this one really closely.
Yeah. You know, it sounds like it's just a tragic situation, and, you know, some of the aspects within the case, you know, seem to be coming. It's not much of a mystery. Let me just say that.
One note on this, you know, the last time that we did a transgender murders, podcast. There's a few things here. We're focusing on newer murders, all that happened this year. There's not much info. That's why we're not devoting an entire episode to one and then an entire episode next week to another. Yep. There's just not that much info that's out there because they're not cold cases yet, but they still need to be solved. So we need to get this information out there. Second thing is that, you know, I made the mistake, and I make the mistake sometimes, of reading our reviews. Now, the reviews usually are... Most of the time, they're great and everybody's wonderful. And then you get, you know, people there that hated on us for talking about BLM, which I have no qualms about. You know, we talked about it. We'll talk about it again. People that And then they constantly would say this, and I have a feeling we're going to get this with this one too, is that stop politicizing and talking about politics. I listen to your podcast, and I listen to podcasts as an escape from politics. I just want to say to everybody, you're listening to a podcast about people being murdered. I understand what you're saying, that is, it is a form of entertainment, is a form of escape, but you know, the two are definitely intertwined. We're probably going to get some bad reviews. You know, we're going to cover many different cases today, and it highlights this epidemic of violence against transgender women, and particularly Black transgender women. And each deserves justice. We're going to start with the first reported transgender Black woman murdered in 2021. 28-year-old Davaria Alexander was born and raised in Chicago. From a young age, she was involved in dance, taking classes at the Chicago Youth Dance Coalition. She even taught some of these dance moves to her best friend, Nikyla. She and Nikyla both came out as transgender women together as teens. The two women did everything together. And according to the Block Club Chicago, having Davaria with her through transitioning was a blessing. Davaria was artistic and creative. Fashion came second nature to her. In early 2021, she was living with her mom in Chicago, and she was loved by so many people in her community and her boyfriend, Brandon Gowdy.
On January 6th, Davaria and Brandon were walking on the 800 block of West 75th Street, the south side of Chicago, around 5 a.m. Along their walk, a silver car drove by and began shooting. Davaria was shot in the head. Brandon was shot in the lower left side and upper left bicep. Davaria was pronounced dead at the scene, while Brandon was taken to the hospital, where he succumbed to his injuries. The news was devastating to the community. Because of a murder just 2 weeks prior, people in the area wondered if transgender Black women were being targeted. 25-year-old Courtney Ashe Key was friends with Davaria. Ashe's friend Beverly Ross told CBS News she was hilarious and determined. She loved getting her nails done and had colorful hair.
By all accounts, she and Davaria were both the life of the party when they went out. But on Christmas Day 2020, Ashe's life was taken in the same neighborhood where Davaria would later be murdered. Ashe was planning to go to her mother's that Christmas evening. But at 8:35 p.m., Chicago police discovered her body on the 900 block of East 82nd Street. Initially, investigators thought she was a victim of a hit and run with an open wound to the left side of her head. But further examination revealed multiple gunshot wounds. So we have, and we know that Chicago has been plagued with so much gun violence,
yeah,
and so many murders. We have two victims, same demographics. What should police be doing to see if there is a possible serial offender? And obviously, we're looking at, we know the first thing that they should be doing is looking at video, but anything else they should be doing?
Yeah, you know, this is a tough type of case from an evidence standpoint. If, you know, obviously Davaria was shot in basically a drive-by. And Ashe, there's not enough information to say it was a drive-by. But if it was, you know, now you have physical distance between the killer or killers and the victims. And so that limits the amount of evidence. The primary evidence that is being left behind is going to be, in addition to, you know, maybe, you know, the witnesses and video surveillance, is going to be the firearms evidence, you know, the bullets that were used, and maybe some cartridge cases, you know, ended up being ejected out of the window of the car as the shots were fired. You know, of course, you want to see, was the same gun used in both cases? And this is where now, you know, we kind of get into the definition of a serial offender. And serial in this case is not necessarily talking about the fantasy motivated killer. Now you may be dealing with, if these two cases are related to who these victims are, then you are now dealing with a predator that is targeting a certain victim and is doing it from afar. And the primary motive is to kill and send a message of hate.
And you'd also probably, you'd want to look at, especially because they're doing it from afar, they very well might have shot and missed at some point too. So going through all of the files and going through, you know, it comes down to victimology. All right. Where else had this potentially happened where you had a victim, that was a Black transgender woman who might have gotten a wound or might have been, shot at, but then they missed.
Right.
And then, you know, this is the time when you have to just be in touch with that community. So friends and family of both women believe they were victims of hate crimes. But when asked, the police said they don't know, saying, quote, "It's really difficult to prove unless you have someone in custody. It's just so hard to classify something as a hate crime without a lot of evidence pointing to that." And again, dealing with the Chicago Police Department, on one case, I remember that very well could have been looked at as a hate crime. At the end of the day, it's not really up to the police to say that it's a hate crime. It's more about when you do have somebody in custody and then you go to charges, because the charges will be a lot more. So that really is the DA's office. But you just have to sort of leave that up in the air. So I understand where they're going with that.
Well, it is very tough without knowing the motive of the offender to classify it as a hate crime. You know, of course, you take a look at the victimology and you say, okay, this is something that could, you know, be the reason why these two victims were killed. But fundamentally, you know, to classify as a hate crime is to take a look at the motivation of the offender. And until you identify the offender, or unless the offender leaves evidence of their motivation at the crime scene or with further communication, such as, you know, the typical, you know, symbols, the burning of the cross, swastikas, you know, stuff that is obviously associated with some sort of prejudice and bias against a group. You don't know until you identify the person, interview the person, or see, you know, what they're about. And then you go, yeah, their motivation was because of this characteristic of the person. So now we're going to go to Albany, Georgia. In 2019, Serenity Hollis moved from Orlando to Albany, Georgia. Her time in Albany was met with at least two attacks. The first was in April of 2019. On the 15th, Serenity was outside of the House of Jazz on West Highland Avenue. She and a man could be seen arguing on a surveillance camera. The man was punching Serenity, and she ran to the porch. There, the man pulled a knife and stabbed Serenity 22 times, leaving the blade in her head. The man then left the scene in a car driven by a woman. The authorities arrived at 5:45 p.m. to the scene. Police put out a request to the public after seeing the surveillance video. 6 days later, they arrested Shannar Edwards. Edwards was sentenced to 20 years for the aggravated assault and an additional 5 for using a knife during a crime. The earliest possible date of parole is 2026.
Now, despite being stabbed 22 times and being left for dead with a blade in her head, Serenity recovered from this attack, and she was well enough to begin a new job at Sanderson Farms Poultry Plant in December of 2020. Serenity would be on that same block of West Highland Avenue earlier this year. She was walking along the street about 4 a.m. when she was shot and killed. And police were able to find surveillance footage of this attack, and we've got the surveillance video. We're going to put it up on all of our social channels. So, Paul, in this image, they put a blue box over her body, and you see an offender running away from her, away from the camera, very grainy.
Yeah.
And all you can really see is kind of like white shoes.
Right. Right. You know, and at least with what I can determine in terms of just the physical appearance of the shooter, looks like the shooter's male. You know, that's my impression. For me, you know, this is where I would want to see everything. I don't want to see the blue box. I need to see that interaction, the offender-victim interaction, because that is so critical to understand what's going on here. And unfortunately, in this video, I can't see that. But at least there's some aspect of the offender that is seen. It's just that it's so dark. He's moving pretty quickly from right to left in the video, that outside of, you know, maybe wearing jeans and having white shoes, you know, it's hard to determine anything concrete about who the offender is.
I mean, you got to look at the gait of the person, which is at least something to go on. And when you say that, okay, I know somebody that possibly runs like that, hopefully they scanned the area and looked around for other video.
Yeah.
How often, You know, it's Albany, Georgia. I don't know what the resources are like there, but hopefully they did canvass the area and canvass a wide area too. It's not just, oh, we're just going to go around for two blocks. You know, you can often find something of a guy that's walking around. Remember, this is 4 a.m., May 8th, 4 a.m. Of this year. Not many people are going to be walking around Albany, Georgia at 4 a.m.
No, you know, and this is where now part of the investigation is okay, what are the cell phones saying? What does Serenity's cell phone indicate? Did they do tower dumps? Have they gone through the tower dumps to see if they have any numbers that are popping? Mm-hmm. You know, there's aspects to where you could potentially identify this person. Right now we're assuming it's a random crime, but it's possible that maybe this was a planned meetup and this guy he lured her, isolated her. That's what these, you know, that's what offenders do, is they want to isolate and then takes advantage and shoots and runs off, you know. So, it, you know, the computer, the you know, the high tech side is huge in a case like this.
So it's interesting that you say that, because unlike with the Chicago murderers, the law enforcement in Serenity's murder, the DA at least, is saying that this is a hate crime. And the DA, a guy named Greg Edwards, said, I cannot go into specifics of everything about what happened, but it was pretty apparent that was probably a motivation for the death. We can't really see anything that's going on from what they've showed us. And obviously, they're keeping stuff close to the vest, but they seem to say that, you know, this is a hate crime. And her family believes that she was either the target of a hate crime or that the killing was an act of revenge. But police are hoping by releasing the video and some information that they'll find somebody who may have seen something in the area.
Yeah, you know, and the prior crime where she stabbed 22 times and she and this Edwards character is arrested, you know, his background would be interesting. Is he associated or affiliated with a group that has a certain philosophy? Is he a gang member? You know, I'd want to know more about him and see, is there somebody that's within his sphere of influence that could be a suspect in the actual shooting death of Serenity?
Yeah. And you have to think, too, that, you know, if she was attacked 2 years ago, you'd hope that there was more of a patrol or police presence in that same area, because it was almost the exact, it was the same block.
Yeah. Now we need to go to Houston. The month before Serenity's murder, 22-year-old Ira Santos was from Houston and the youngest of four children. Her mother, Maria, called her daughter a beautiful soul. According to her mother, Iris was bullied. People would throw trash cans at her. In an article by the Human Rights Campaign, her theater teacher said Iris knew what she wanted in life, as she was not ashamed of who she was. She was a confident Latinx woman and wanted to go to Hollywood. But in the meantime, she had an online business selling candles and soaps. She also read tarot cards and did makeup consultations.
On April 23rd, 2021, Iris was eating on a picnic table outside the Chick-fil-A on Westheimer Road. At 9:32 p.m., someone approached her and shot her multiple times. And like in Serenity's case, there was surveillance footage of the shooter running away. Now, the first part of the video is from inside of the Chick-fil-A, where you can see the suspect at first calmly walking by the windows. And the second portion of him looks to be from a dash cam, where you see him on the sidewalk running, and then he goes into this apartment complex before law enforcement apparently loses him. Now, taking a look at this case and this video, the one thing that stands out with this guy, he's got black shoes and he has either white or really, really light gray pants on. They're either sweatpants or they're could be jeans or something like that.
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, in terms of the coloration of his clothes, as he's, you know, I'm watching him right now walking down the street. You know, he does have the dark upper clothes. Now he's running a little bit, the lighter pants and dark shoes. But I think, you know, again, we're not seeing, you know, anything to be able to identify characteristics, but it's also important that, you know, just like in Serenity's case, and this is where the, you know, the blue box in Serenity's case kind of bugs me a little bit in terms of seeing what's going on. But it's not like that these shootings appear, you know, financially motivated. They're not rifling through pockets like they're trying to steal, you know, cash or jewelry or a gun or whatever they think that the victim may be carrying. You know, this is where this is just to kill. That's the primary focus. And that's where it now appears that either there's some prior relationship that is causing a vindictive type revenge homicide, or the homicide is related to who the victim is and nothing more.
Yeah. Yes. And, you know, one of the things for this case is, you know, white pants or incredibly light gray pants are not a thing that most guys wear. And, you know, talking with the detective, he said they believe it is a black male, but they're not quite sure. And they're even not quite sure if it's a male. Could potentially be, could have been a female. But, you know, for people out there who know this area of Houston, who've been around this Chick-fil-A, who wears white pants? Bottom line, who wears white pants, who wears light gray pants, because it's not a normal thing. So that's something you always looking for, something to latch on to. You can see him run. He's got a fairly, it almost looks like, I think they might have slowed down the him running, because he looks like he's running in slow motion.
Yeah.
I would have liked to have seen him running as he's running, just so you can see if there's anything interesting with his gait.
Sure.
But I think those white pants are something pretty specific.
Yep. Nope. Absolutely.
So this assailant, after shooting her, went into an apartment complex, you know, went up the road a little bit and then went into this apartment complex, which it looks like that's where the he was lost by police. And this apartment complex is pretty gigantic. It's on a street called Lazy Hollow Drive.
Yeah, you know, and looking at this, I know Houston PD did a good job. They canvassed this entire apartment complex, hoping to, you know, find witnesses or maybe, you know, the suspect himself, the offender himself. Yeah. But, you know, at the same time, it draws up the question, when this is something I have seen other offenders do, where they will park their vehicles in an apartment complex such as this, you know, because it's transient. You have all sorts of transient people going in and out, visiting, you know, the residents, and they have the guest parking. So is it possible, you know, he could live there, or he just parked his vehicle there in a guest parking lot, just blending in, and that's where he ran to after he did the homicide.
Yeah. And it's worth noting as well that this is where Iris lived. So yeah, you often think about people that are running away from somebody. Often it's a natural instinct to run towards your home, you know, run towards someplace that you know about, that you might know a little bit more about the streets, et cetera. And the little nooks and crannies of this place. But, you know, this is a complex of two-story large buildings, and there's just a ton of them. And you're right, there's a ton of places to park, too.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's hard to say what exactly is going on. But, you know, they have the video, and that's what's important, is we need to kind of figure out if anybody can recognize anything about this guy as he's, you know, jogging along. This is where probably your geo-targeting technique, you know, might be worthwhile to do.
I talked to the detective and he said they were up for it, so I'm going to start a campaign.
Cool.
This week.
Okay.
Yep. Iris's mother wasn't even notified by the police. She found out about her daughter's murder from a neighbor 2 days after that. And according to Houston PD, a month after Iris's murder, they were still unsure if the attack was a hate crime. But, you know, like you said, it's either, you know, digging into this person's background to see if there was some sort of personal beef, or this could be somebody coming up and shooting them,
yep.
You know,
yep.
Just for whatever reason, or some guy who, you know, that sort of, you always the defense that has happened, which is trans panic, which some guy is so insecure in his masculinity that once he realizes that he has been talking to a trans woman, freaks out and then kills them.
Right.
Which is basically what that is just, you know, a person is such a freaking moron and he, you know, isn't secure in that. Obviously, thankfully, that's no longer a defense that is being used, but that very well could have been a potential thing that happened because there's a lot of morons out there.
So, and now to Miami, Florida. 45-year-old Alexis Braxton, also known as Kimmy Icon, was a hairstylist at Jackie's Styling Salon. She was incredibly active on social media. She often posted videos about her new looks and issues that mattered. Her Facebook profile said, "I'm a trans, living my truth well-established, and trans lives matter and black lives matter as well." On February 2nd, Alexis posted on Facebook saying, quote, "Morning, February. Please be good to me and my family. I'm living in peace. Surviving the hate after so many years," unquote. The next day, she posted a video of her new red bob hairdo. She was also active on OnlyFans and posted about a new video dropping soon about Valentine's Day. But on February 4th, Alexis' mom, Jonita, tried to reach her. She called her all day. But when there was no response, she and one of her daughters headed to Alexis' apartment in the Carmel at the California Club condo complex.
The two women arrived around 10 p.m. According to the Gay City News, the women felt like something was suspicious, so instead of entering on their own, they called the police. When the police arrived, they opened the door, and they discovered Alexis's body. The cause of death has not been released, but it was reported that she was shot. Now, Miami-Dade police are not releasing a lot of details of the homicide because they say for fear that it would jeopardize their investigation, but they did comment that it was, quote, violent and vicious. So it's frustrating. We know no details about this. We don't know if anything was taken from the home. But Paul, you know, we've been dealing with murders that were happening on the street versus now this one is something that happened in the home. What is the benefit for investigating a crime that happens in somebody's home in terms of being able to find out who did it?
Well, you know, this is where you get into the fundamentals of transfer evidence, you know, and this is, in fact, I just talked about this on the crime cruise. You know, Locard's principle is no two objects can come in contact with each other without leaving evidence that they were in contact. So when you have an offender going into the victim's own environment, that offender is leaving evidence of his presence in that environment versus being out in a public location on a street, as an example. You know, if this is somebody that has never been inside that house before, it's not a consensual partner, it's not a friend, etc., then their latent prints, their DNA, their trace evidence, etc., becomes very incriminating if found. You know, and the other thing, though, is reading into the authorities' comment of violent and vicious. They generally wouldn't use that if, let's say, the victim had just opened up the door and was shot there. You know, that is a relatively straightforward type of case. So when they make a comment, it was violent and vicious. This sounds like there was very close contact between the offender and the victim, such as maybe there was a bludgeoning occurring, there was a fight between them, you know, fisticuffs, you know, blows being thrown. This increases the likelihood that evidence from the offender was captured in the victim's body, underneath fingernails, on knuckles, in the crime scene itself. If the offender got hurt, and, you know, let's say got punched in the nose and has a bleeding nose and now has left, you know, drops of blood. You know, so that's the hope, is that they are dealing with that kind of situation. And it's just a matter of time until this killer is identified.
So law enforcement has said they're looking into all angles at the moment, including the possibility of a hate crime. And like Iris's and Serenity's cases, there is surveillance video. The video is from the condo complex. Miami-Dade police hasn't called this person in the video a suspect, but they think that they might have some information. Detective Juan Segovia told People magazine, "We always believe that somebody saw something that they may not even realize that's going to help us on this case. Maybe somebody heard something that night, saw something that was out of place, something suspicious that they haven't come forth with. We're urging those people to come forth." Now, this video is different than the, and we're going to be posting this on our social media channels as well. This is a much clearer shot. It's from the front. You can't quite see the person's face, but it looks like a male probably a white male with skinny jeans, a white belt, and a jacket with a hood on it, but the hood is almost wearing it like it's a cape. So the hood is on his head, but the jacket is kind of draped over his shoulders, and it looks like he's on his cell phone.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is huge in terms of, you know, the amount of information that could be gathered from this video. You know, in addition to what you described, you know, now you could determine the stature, the height of this person. You know, here, you know exactly. I mean, he literally is stepping on this dividing line between the sidewalk to the cement patio leading up to the stairs. I mean, based on, you know, using, you know, dimensional information with this photo, you could get the approximate height. And he looks like he's hunched over a little bit because he's kind of, you know, got his head down a little bit as he's on his phone. But it's very informative. And, you know, somebody is not necessarily going to recognize his face. You can't see his face, but his build, you get a sense, his clothing, you can see his clothing. You almost, I'm looking at the white lettering or something that's on his chest on the shirt. And it's like, oh, I just wish I could, you know, make that out, you know, but posting this into, you know, an area, potentially going to be, you're going to get witnesses coming forward saying, hey, that looks like so-and-so. But he's got a cell phone. You know? Mm-hmm. So now, so geez, you know, cell tower dumps, you know, he's in the area. I would even be looking at, you know, if he's been in this area before, you know, is his cell phone, you know, registering, you know, to Wi-Fi networks, you know, and it's something that's logged, you know, there's stuff here that can be worked with for sure.
Absolutely. And taking a look at him, you know, he has two very distinctive things that he does. Anybody that wears a coat like this with it draped over like you're wearing a cape, that's weird. Someone's going to be able to see this and say, I know somebody that does that. And he also has a white belt. And it's a white belt that sort of the way that the belts used to be in the 80s, where there was like a really long piece of the belt that sort of like flops down.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yep.
Remember those?
Yep. Yep.
That's what he's doing. So somebody is, you know, if you were able to show this to everybody, and I'm going to, we haven't talked to the Miami-Dade police, they haven't called us back, but they got to be able to find this guy, no doubt about it. So
definitely,
we're going to definitely stay on them about that.
Detective Segovia went on to say, the family has been left with no closure. They're suffering tremendously because of the death and the manner in which our victim was murdered. Alexis' sister echoed the sentiment when speaking to NBC Miami. She said, quote, whoever did this, you need to come forward. You hurting our family. You hurting everyone around us. And we want to know why. Why would you do it? Why would the reason be for you to do such a crime and do such an act on a beautiful person? Unquote.
So before we get into the weekly assignment, we want to discuss the 38th known victim. 21-year-old Kier LaPree Cartier had just recently transitioned. She was a Dallas native. She's very strong, very independent. And on September 30th, she was having dinner at a friend's house in Dallas around 7:30 p.m. As she left the house, she said she needed to make a quick trip to Arlington. She didn't say why or what was in Arlington, but 2 hours later, a passerby on Stone Trail Road placed a call to law enforcement to say an unresponsive person was inside a running car. Police arrived on the scene. The car was still running. The driver's side door was open. Kier was shot. Police haven't said if anything was missing. They aren't sure why Kier was at the apartment complex, and they're hoping to find surveillance video. So obviously, this one is incredibly new. Not much about this case at all. But, you know, we wanted to get it out there because it's another case that we hope doesn't get shuffled aside.
Yeah. And again, we don't know what the motivation of the offender was. Was it because of who Kier was, or was there something else going on? Was there a robbery that went awry? But at least they are trying to find the surveillance video and hopefully they get something good.
Yes. Okay. So that's going to take us to our weekly assignment. I know we covered a lot of cases today. We're going to go back over them. 28-year-old Davaria Alexander and Courtney Key were both murdered on the south side of Chicago just 2 weeks apart. Courtney was shot on Christmas Day on East 82nd Street. Davaria and her boyfriend, Brandon Gowdy, were shot on January 6th around 5 a.m. on the 800 block of West 75th Street. The shooter of Davaria is thought to have been in a silver car, and it's unknown if these crimes are connected. We don't know if they compared ballistics or anything. 24-year-old Serenity Hollis survived a vicious stabbing attack in April of 2019. But then on May 8th of 2021, a man approached her on the same block of West Highland Avenue in Albany, Georgia, and shot her.
22-year-old Ira Santos was shot sitting at a picnic table in Houston, Texas. She was outside the Chick-fil-A on Westheimer Road at 9:32 p.m. A man in a dark-colored sweater and gray or white sweatpants was seen fleeing the scene. 45-year-old Alexis Kimmy Icon Braxton was active on social media until February 4th, 2021. That day, her mother tried to reach her and could not. Upon arriving at her home in the Carmel at the California Club condo complex, they called police. Alexis had been murdered. Police are hoping someone with information will come forward.
So there's a lot there. This is going to be something really where we want you to share these on social media. I know that on Instagram, it's come, it's gotten a lot harder to share things onto your stories, but especially if you are in any of these areas, we're going to be posting each of these cases throughout the week separately. So you'll be able to share them. You know the rules, no naming names in public, unlike what just happened with Zodiac. Don't dox each other and be nice. That takes us to our weekly distraction. Paul, I'm going to go first this time.
Do it.
You know, we both love a good liquor store. And Matt Oswalt, who is Patton Oswalt's brother and a very funny guy, very funny writer, his book, which I own, called Liquor Stores and Detours, is in its third printing. And I don't know if you've ever seen these pictures, but he's been referred to as the Ansel Adams of liquor stores. Hmm. He goes around and he takes these amazing photos of liquor stores, which is just so bizarre. But some of the photos are just so beautiful. And I actually own a print of one of them that I purchased from him. So there's he shoots from, he also travels too, but a lot of them are from the LA area, and a lot of them are places that I've actually been to.
Yeah. Now I'm looking at some of these photos that you've linked to, and yeah, it is amazing. You know, and there's an artistic aspect here. You've got this, this liquor store that looks like it's, it's lit up at night, the sun is setting, and it's just like, wow, that looks really cool.
Yeah.
He does a great job.
Now, there's one called the Mojave Junior Liquor and Market, and there's also a motel next to it too. And it's such a great picture, and it's probably my favorite one, but it's on the cover of the book, so I didn't want to order that one. I didn't want to be that guy. But yeah, so all right, what's been distracting you? So yeah, go check it out. By the way, Matt Oswalt is his name. Follow him on Twitter or on Instagram, and then you can find information if you want to check out the book.
Yeah, for me, I was gone for a handful of days with the crime crews. And so, my tank was being watched by somebody else. So I didn't know what was going on. And I come back and I think I've lost a fish. And so I'm actually a little bit upset because I think it was my favorite fish in the tank. It's this tail spot blenny. And I thought, well, maybe he's just hiding in the rocks. And it's been several days and he hasn't come out even at feeding. And I have a lid on the aquarium for those that have saltwater tanks. Some of these fish will jump out of the tank. He's not on the floor. And, right before I left, I put a cleanup crew in that included a couple of hermit crabs and a couple of emerald crabs. And I'm just kind of wondering if my fish just got consumed. I don't know. I'm really,
oh, man, I'm sorry.
I'm besides myself on that. So I'm kind of hoping he pops out. And if not, I love that type of fish so much. I'll probably replace him, but, I hate the idea, but that's part of this hobby, is you are going to lose fish here and there or other animals. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that he does come out and he's just been fooling me,
Yeah, I hope he does. And, starring in Finding Nemo 3 will be Paul Holes. If anybody wants to do some artwork for that, I think that would be wonderful. But I'm sorry, buddy. Yeah.
Yeah.
It might be the circle of life, though.
It's part of that, but you do get attached to these little guys.
Did you name it?
Just Blenny. You know, I don't Blenny. Come up with it. Oh, it's just Blenny. Yeah. You know, but he was really cool, and he kind of established himself, and he would just kind of, you know, go around the rocks and pick little things off, and he was almost eel-like. He would just kind of go into the little holes in the rocks, and don't know what happened. I was looking for, remains.
Hopefully he's hiding. So finding Blenny will be coming to a theater near you soon. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Rate, review, and subscribe, which would be wonderful, particularly the reviews. Buy some merch. Christmas and Hanukkah and Kwanzaa, everything's coming up for the holidays. Follow us on our social media channels. Until next week, keep digging.
Keep digging. Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad, is produced by Exactly Right Media and Bench Clearing Productions. Senior producer, Pauly Katowski. Associate producer, Haley Gray. Engineer, Stephen Ray Morris. Music, Tom Breifogel. Executive producers, Karen Kilgariff, Georgia Hardstark, Danielle Kramer.